I think that social media is beneficial in the sense that it's where people are, and it's beneficial in that it allows for back and forth communication. People watch less and less television these days, and anyhow, you can't talk back to the person on the television. And so what I enjoy about social media is the ability to have a back and forth and to start an exchange. And look, we all know that a lot of that you see anger and hate and aggressiveness, but I've also begun correspondences that were really, really thoughtful, including with people who I disagree with but can learn from because of social media.
How do you frame it so that that outcome is more common than the trollery that is usual in comments sections?
Well, I think it's important to do your very best to be respectful in your approach and not to be belligerent. But I also will acknowledge that no matter how hard you try, there will be some trollery, and you have to have the consistency, let's say, and patience to just ignore the trolls, which can be a little painful, but is important to do.
Legitimate and illegitimate uses, in an ethical sense, of social media as a practical part of politics.
Well, I think the illegitimate uses are all around abuse. There are, as you know, there are people with big social media followings who are able to direct their followings to go after someone, to attack someone. We, of course, saw the nationally discussed episode with Leslie Jones, and I'm glad we had that discussion as a nation, but the truth is we had it because she's a celebrity, and there are many, many people, particularly women and people of color, who undergo that kind of treatment every day and don't get a lot of attention because they're not already celebrities.
Does this sort of behavior tell us that we're not as great a people as we thought we were, or is there an unsavory lack of a check on personal behavior created by the apparent anonymity?
Well, when you ask the question that's so well put, what am I supposed to say besides yes? I think you absolutely hit the nail on the head. There is darkness in people, and there is anger in people, and there is unkindness in people, and we build social structures to make it easier to keep that in check. And some of that is what it means to look at each other face to face. We're sitting here in the studio right now, we're making eye contact. It would be really uncomfortable for me to look in your eyes and say to you some of the things that people very freely type to each other behind their anonymous handles in comment sections online. And so we've spent millennia, maybe even longer, building up the social structures that keep us in check in person-to-person conversations. We don't have that online, and I think we need to figure out how to build it quickly if we want online discourse to be healthy and positive and constructive.
Ideas on how to do that?
I think moderation is really important. For example, as a person in state government, I read the Capital Facts blog a lot, and things get pretty intense there, but the proprietor of the blog, Rich Miller, is not shy about deleting comments that are inappropriate. He says, this is not a First Amendment zone. This is my house, and you're my guests, and you'll speak in a way that's consistent with my values. And by throwing people out if they're not willing to meet that basic standard of decency, he attracts people who want that decency, and then that becomes a virtuous cycle.
You have stepped up to run the leading Illinois Tomorrow or Lyft pack, backed by unions, that is going up with a lot of advertising, a couple million bucks worth, trying to link Donald Trump to Bruce Rauner, the governor, in spite of Rauner's efforts to stay away from Trump. You're leading the Road Back program, an effort to increase the minimum wage in the state. These are fairly high-profile party roles. You took a flyer on running for comptroller. Are you thinking about running for governor?
I'm not thinking about that at all. There's an election that's going to happen in literally less than 3 weeks that is, on a national level, consequential beyond belief, and on a state level, pretty darn important, too. The state's in a shambles. We don't have a budget. We're sitting here on a public university campus. Our higher education system is being just viciously decimated by this situation, as is our human service network. Our credit rating is going down. Our fiscal integrity is going down. We have a lot of work to do as soon as we get through this election to get the state on the right track. And I just don't feel like now is the time for me to be planning an election campaign for myself at all. There's a lot of other work that I'm hoping to do to improve the quality of life for the people of Illinois.
Who are the potential likely candidates? Attorney General Lisa Madigan, not while her father, the Speaker, is still in office. Senator Dick Durbin has recently said, after a little bit of consideration and flirtation with the idea, that, you know, he's pretty happy in the Senate. The Democrat bench, in a statewide sense, may not be all that deep right now. Who do you think would be good names?
Well, I have not spoken directly with Senator Durbin about this, but I didn't read his comments to completely shut the door. He is, of course, the only Democratic United States senator from Illinois, but we have a number of United States members of Congress who are, in some cases, rising in the party and worthy of consideration. You know, there are a few big counties where countywide elected officials are could make a jump to a statewide stage, and there is obviously some state legislators as well. What I can tell you is that the state is heading in a really dangerous direction, and I think we need a Democrat to run. We need a Democrat to defeat Rauner, and we need that Democrat who will defeat Rauner to do it on a positive platform for what the state actually needs to get back on track, so that you don't just win an election to defeat someone, you win an election to develop a mandate to start to implement solutions that will really work for Illinois.
And we'll get to that in one more question. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're speaking with State Senator Daniel Biss, Democrat of Evanston. You said you're not willing to consider it right now pending the election, but that is not the same as saying no. Are you saying no, or are you saying, wait, it's not the right time for anybody to say it right now, whether you would consider a run for governor?
I don't think it's the right time for anyone to say it right now, and it's not in the forefront of my mind. And I think if it were the forefront of my mind, that wouldn't speak too well for me. There's a lot of other work that needs to be done first.
And so on to wrong directions. Social services have been cut a lot in McLean County because of the budget standoff. The Elder Exploitation Investigation Unit at a local agency, PATH, has had layoffs. They're trying to keep the doors open, in fact, a suicide hotline. Mm-hmm. A mental health services provider told me a man came to the office saying he was having ideations of killing his father. And the first question she had to ask him was, are you on Medicaid because I can't help you otherwise? That's not really a question that one wants to ask a person who's having that sort of vision. The stories are legion. How much responsibility for the damage done to the state does your party bear?
Nobody gets off the hook here. Nobody. And I feel the weight of that very, very powerfully. I do think that the direction the governor has chosen is destructive. I think the governor has made it difficult to achieve compromise because of the combative way that he approached his job from day one. But that doesn't mean that it's not my job to find compromise. It is my job to find compromise, and I don't think I deserve to rest until we've succeeded in doing that.
Please address this argument. Democrats say they value families and working people. The damage done to the people, the economy, the institutions, and the reputation of the state by this impasse outweighs any momentary political disadvantage from solving the issue in a single-party way by exercising veto-proof majorities.
Democrats actually don't have functioning veto-proof majorities. As you likely know,
This is a debatable issue as to whether you can round them up, but okay, go on.
Well, so you need 71 votes in the House to override a veto and 36 in the Senate. And there have been a number of situations where Democrats have been able to round up 36 Senate votes to override a veto or do something else that requires a supermajority. There has not been a single instance where on a matter of partisan dispute, all 71 House Democrats have stuck together. There has been one veto that was overridden against the strong wishes of the governor, but that was done with 72 votes, three Republicans and voted yes, and two Democrats voted no.
So how bad does it have to get before the Democrats will all pull together?
Well, I hate to just spout cliches on such a serious topic, but we all remember what Will Rogers said. Will Rogers said that he doesn't belong to an organized party. He's a Democrat. And we're a diverse party. We've got people from the inner cities of Chicago. We have people from the southernmost tip of Illinois, bordering Kentucky and Missouri. We have suburbanites. We have people from central Illinois. And it's difficult. But we have to work within our party to achieve unanimity so as to move the state forward, and we have to work with the other party to achieve compromise so as to move the state forward.
There has also been a lack of clear articulation of a detailed vision of the Democrat view of how to get out of this mess. And I get that neither side really wants to go there until it's a done deal. But certainly things are getting bad enough, aren't they, to tip your hand a little bit more than it has been.
You know what? I think that's fair. I think that Governor Rauner was elected and laid out his agenda. I personally think it's a dreadful agenda, but I believe that he sincerely means that that's the right way forward, and I commend him for saying what's in it. Things like right to work and repealing the prevailing wage, going after unions. I think he's doing that out of conviction. The problems are real, and those of us who strongly disagree with his proposed solutions, I think, have an obligation to lay out our own. And I think there's some solutions that would be really beneficial for the state, and the Democrats ought to be able to rally around. For example, we are one of only four states in the union whose constitution mandates a flat income tax. That is an unusual situation to be in. Democrats and Republicans across the country agree that it's fair to ask people who make a little more money to pay a little bit more, and so to not especially harm middle-class families with your tax code. And I think Democrats should stand together and say, if we were to repeal that provision of the Constitution, that would be a structural reform that would help us have balanced budgets in the future while still being fair to middle-class families.
If you were in the room crafting a compromise, and short of a constitutional amendment like that, which is a heavy lift and requires a vote of the people, mm-hmm. what would you recommend for cuts and revenue enhancements?
Well, I think on revenue, I think we need to do what we can to make the tax code fairer. And so if that doesn't mean changing the Constitution, it means increasing the earned income tax credit, increasing the child tax credit, increasing the personal exemption. It means shifting away from property taxes, which are a very unfair tax. It means improving our education funding system, which currently is very, very property tax reliant and very inequitable, harming the poorest communities across the state, and directing the funds in a way that's more equitable, which would do a lot for educational attainment and to improve our budget because it would be the most efficient possible utilization of resources. And then on other areas of spending, this isn't a complicated or sexy answer, but we just need to be restrained. We need to be disciplined. We need to say, listen, it would be nice to be able to spend lots more money, but we don't have the room right now for significant increases.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're speaking with State Senator Daniel Biss of Evanston. How might a constitutional amendment on the flat tax be brought forward in such a way as to make it palatable? Because we do rely on property taxes in the absence of the income tax.
That's a great question. I think that if you just put a tax amendment to the Constitution on the ballot as an abstract concept, people are going to be nervous, as they should be, because people feel anxiety about the extent to which they're being taxed. If instead you make it a part of a package and you tell people, here's what the package is, here's how the income tax code will change, here's why that will allow us to balance our budget without shredding the kind of services that the most vulnerable people rely on, and here's what the impact will be on property taxes, you put it all in a package where the math adds up. You put a bow on it and then ask the public to vote on that package, not just on some theory of taxation. I think you have a much better chance. And I think you're also doing your duty in presenting the people with something realistic.
You have the property tax issue, which can be solved legislatively, and you have the income tax issue, which can only be solved or addressed in a constitutional amendment. Do you pass contingent legislation in the General Assembly saying, if the Constitution changes, we'll do X to property taxes? How does that work?
That's exactly what I've always advocated. I would say, figure out what you want to do. Lots of it is just legislative change, and some of it would be a constitutional change. And the way you write the laws is they all say, hey, this law goes into effect when the constitutional amendment passes. And so then people are voting on a whole package, because if they pass the constitutional amendment, it triggers a lot of other legal changes. And then you really have the ability and the responsibility to put before people, hey, on the one hand, here's the status quo. On the other hand, here's the new option. Tell us which one you prefer.
You might get some Republicans to go for the property tax part of it, but most Republicans are fairly devoted to the idea of flat tax, and the lower the better. Is there a sentiment that you've seen among the people across the aisle that they might go for this shotgun wedding?
You know, in Illinois recently, the devotion to the flat tax has become a Republican idea. I would stress that that's not the picture nationally. For example, who's in my mind, the person who's viewed as the biggest national guru on conservative budgeting is probably Paul Ryan. The Paul Ryan budget does not have a flat income tax. There are states run by Republicans across the union, including many of our neighboring states like Wisconsin and Iowa, that have very progressive income taxes. And so this is not a concept that is philosophically anathema to Republicans. It's kind of a political position they've taken in recent years. And so I would say that we need to be willing to negotiate. There, as you say, there are aspects of property tax change that Republicans would love, and we have to be have give and take on both sides. But I don't think of this as something that the national evidence suggests is some kind of red line that Republicans aren't willing to cross. On the contrary, Republicans seem very prepared on the federal level and in most states to embrace a fair income tax.
Senator Biss, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.